a new update. But this time, it wasn't the prosecution doing the talking. It was the defense.
32-year-old DeAndre Booker of Roseville faced a judge today.
Body cam footage, crossed wires,
and you have any actual proof that she's dead and not alive?
Definitive proof? No, sir.
And a strategy that questions whether police may have gone too far.
This third time they're not looking for a body.
They questioned everything. From the tip that led officers to DeAndre's door.
No.
To the way they entered his apartment.
Did you actually open the door by force?
They even floated a chilling possibility. What if someone else was responsible all along? In this episode, we examine the cracks they're trying to create and whether it's all part of a much bigger play. But to understand how we got here, you'll want to start with my first deep dive on Ashley's case, then watch the next chapter and the moment when everything changed. Now this is what comes next. Hello, and welcome to today's episode of Sleuthy Stories. If you're new here, this is the podcast where real-life mysteries unfold, one clue at a time. The audio for today's story has been pulled from my main YouTube channel and remastered for this podcast experience. If you'd like to see the visuals that accompany this case, head over to my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. But for now, sit back, listen closely, and let's unravel the mystery together. Thanks for being here. Today's episode is sponsored by Aura, a comprehensive service that protects you and your loved ones from those who wish to exploit your trust online. Ever get one of those strange text messages from USPS saying they have a package for you? Click this link to confirm. USPS never sends those types of messages. That's spam from scammers who likely got your information from a data broker or a leak on the dark web. Do you know how much of your personal information is out there? Your full name, phone number, home address, email, even details about your relatives can be sold to scammers, like the ones behind that USPS text message. That's why I turned to Aura. Aura not only monitors your information on the dark web, but it also automatically sends opt-out requests to data brokers on your behalf. It has helped me remove my information from over 18 data brokers and even alerted me that one of my email addresses was found on the dark web. With Aura, I also enjoy features like antivirus, VPN, password management, and identity theft insurance, all in one affordable package. If you sign up through my link right now at aura.com/sleuthylucy, Aura will give you a 2-week free trial. For a more direct route, click the link in the description below. Well, hello there, and welcome back. If you're returning to this story, you already know it's one that's left many of us stunned and still searching for answers. This is part of our unfinished series, Stories Still in Motion, where justice hasn't quite caught up to the truth. And today's update adds a new twist to the case of Ashley Elkins, a 30-year-old mother who vanished this past January in Warren, Michigan. But this time, it wasn't the prosecution guiding the courtroom. It was the defense, raising new questions, poking holes, and hinting at a disturbing possibility. What if this wasn't a search for justice, but a rush to judgment? We're going to walk through what happened inside that courtroom, the footage played, the strategy revealed, and what it could mean for whether this case even makes it to trial. If you want to see the full visual breakdown, you can find it on my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. But here, let's dig into the latest developments in the Ashley Elkins case. The courtroom was quiet, not tense, not chaotic. Just quiet. No passionate cross-examinations. No emotional witness testimony. Not this time. Instead, it was the defense, calm, deliberate, and calculated. Their questions weren't designed to make a scene. They were designed to plant seeds. Seeds of doubt, seeds of misdirection. And maybe, just maybe, seeds of a new suspect. It wasn't about what was said out loud. It was about what was implied. And in a case this fragile, implications can be just as dangerous as facts. As the defense took control of the courtroom, their strategy became clear. Challenge everything and point the finger somewhere else. Three officers. 2 days in question. One defense theory, quietly taking shape. At the start of the hearing, the stream wasn't working. And when it finally kicked in, static. Garbled sound. Buzzing. You could barely hear a word. But then, the audio cleared. Just enough. And what came through wasn't noise. It was strategy. A Warren police officer was already mid-testimony, assigned to Ashley's missing persons case the morning after her family filed the report. It landed on his desk on January 3rd. He had been one of the first officers to walk through DeAndre's apartment. But what should have been a straightforward recounting of his actions, a necessary response to a missing woman with a history of domestic violence, took a sharp turn. Attorney Robbie Lang, DeAndre Booker's lawyer, wasn't raising his voice or pounding his fists. He was soft-spoken, measured. And yet, his every word was a dagger, pointing not at his client, but at the officers themselves. You could feel it. He was building something. Slowly, methodically, and with purpose. The implication? That the police overstepped. That they weren't responding to danger. They were launching a witch hunt. He began by challenging the very foundation of how investigators zeroed in on DeAndre. First up, Ashley's best friend, LaShawn Ross. On January 3rd, around 3:22 p.m., surveillance cameras captured LaShawn walking toward DeAndre's apartment. She wasn't alone. Ashley's mother, Monika, and her sister, Anaya, were with her. Roughly 40 minutes after she was caught on camera, heading toward DeAndre's apartment, LaShawn Ross turned over the phone. It was 4 p.m. on January 3rd. According to the officer on the stand, LaShawn initially claimed she found the phone outside, on the ground. But in a follow-up conversation, she later admitted she had been inside DeAndre's apartment. And that's where she actually got it, from the living room table near the couch area. Lang wanted the court to sit with that shift, to wonder, why did the story change? LaShawn later told police how they got inside. A downstairs tenant had let them into the building. And when they reached DeAndre's apartment door, it was already open. But just because the door wasn't locked didn't mean they had permission, at least not according to the defense. Lang pointed out that LaShawn didn't have consent to enter the unit. And the phone she took from inside? He called it theft. She wasn't the only one who'd been there. The officer testified that LaShawn told police Ashley's mother, Monika, had also entered the apartment earlier that morning. So had Ashley's sister. Even the father of Ashley's children. And another friend. Lang's implication was subtle, but clear. If so many people had been in and out of the apartment before police arrived, could someone have moved something? Staged something? Or planted a clue? It was a strategy designed to raise questions and blur the edges of what really happened that day. Earlier in the hearing, he had confronted Ashley's mother, Monika, with that same inconsistency.
The guy downstairs opened up the door.
All right, and then would I be correct in saying that you and some other people went into Mr. Booker's apartment?
Correct.
That afternoon?
Yes.
And it was you, and it was LaShawn Ross, correct?
I think LaShawn was with me. It was a few of us that went in. It was my daughter, Anaya.
And Alexis.
Anaya.
And the father of Ashley's children.
No, he wasn't with me when I went the first time. He was not with me.
You came back later?
As far as I know, he was not with me.
how many times did people in your family go into Mr. Booker's apartment on January 3rd?
I have no idea. I know I went in there once.
Okay. And did you take a phone from Mr. Booker's apartment?
No.
Okay. Did LaShawn Ross take a phone from Mr. Booker's apartment, to your knowledge?
I guess.
Okay. And did you give that phone over to the Warren Police Department?
Yes.
And did you tell the Warren Police Department that you had found that phone on the ground outside of Mr. Booker's apartment?
I don't know. I was not there. I'm not the one who turned it in.
Who
I was not there.
Phone to the Warren Police Department?
LaShawn and my daughter.
And I would be correct in stating that you did not have Mr. Booker's permission to go into his apartment, correct?
Correct.
Was this a mistake, a lie, or just nerves? Either way, the defense wanted the court to see it as muddy, unreliable, potentially inadmissible. But the officer on the stand held firm. He said LaShawn told him she discovered a DoorDash order on the phone, placed the night before. The items? Bleach, gloves, trash bags. The officer didn't ignore it. He got a search warrant to extract the phone's data, and what they found only deepened their concern. There were searches about whether a cell phone could be traced if it was turned off, how to hide, even how to get from shelters in Flint to Ohio. He said it wasn't just the phone. It was everything. Ashley's troubling history with DeAndre. The fact that she was now missing. Her phone pinging near his apartment. And yes, the DoorDash receipt found on the phone that was taken from DeAndre's apartment. The order for bleach, gloves, and garbage bags placed the night Ashley disappeared. It was, in his words, the totality of those things that raised alarm. So that night, January 3rd, around 8:30 p.m., Warren and Roseville police went there, made a coordinated entry into the Roseville apartment. It wasn't a raid. It was a welfare check, a protective sweep. They were looking for Ashley. "Was this an emergency?" Lang asked. "Yes," the officer replied. But the defense didn't agree, and they weren't done. Attorney Lang questioned the urgency of the entire response. He pointed to a critical detail. If this was a true emergency, why did officers wait nearly 26 minutes after arriving at the complex before entering DeAndre's apartment? On the stand, the Warren officer was shown body cam footage. And in that moment, he was forced to admit, it didn't exactly look like a situation unfolding under urgency.
That's you, correct?
That's correct.
And this would be a video of you and everybody from Roseville entering the apartment, correct?
Yes.
So I'd be correct that it's approximately 26 minutes later from the original entry into the lobby before you entered?
Yes, yes.
So does that refresh your recollection of showing up?
I arrived with some Roseville officers. I don't recall those officers being in there upon my arrival.
But I take it there wasn't any type of exigent circumstance to enter into that apartment immediately, correct?
We were checking her welfare.
I got it. It wasn't an emergency, correct?
No.
There was more. The officer testified that he was the first to arrive and that a tenant from the lower floor let them into the building. But the footage told a different story. It showed that another officer had actually entered the building's lobby first, using only light pressure to open the magnetic door. No tenant. No assistance. Just a push. And perhaps most telling, when that officer stepped inside, there were no other officers in the frame, no backup in the lobby, no sign of the officer who was on the stand. In fact, that officer didn't appear until 26 minutes later, at which point, approximately seven officers were now at the scene. That earlier officer, the one who, it appears, entered first, was also called to the stand. He confirmed the door required only a little force. He explained that lobby doors like that are often magnetic, poorly maintained, and rarely secure. This made one thing clear. The Warren officer hadn't remembered things quite right. When asked if he had ordered DeAndre's apartment door to be kicked in, he said no. It didn't need to be, because it was already open. Once inside the apartment, the officers conducted what they called a protective sweep. They opened closets, checked the cabinets beneath the kitchen sink, but Ashley wasn't there. What they did find was a bottle of bleach, a box of garbage bags, and a pair of rubber gloves laid across the couch. Suspicious? Maybe. But the defense seized the moment. They asked the officer on the stand if he found any blood, any signs of a struggle, any sign of foul play. The officer said no. And with that, the sweep should have been over. The officers exited the apartment. But then, they went back in. Not once. Twice. The defense pressed hard. Why return to a place that had already been cleared? So the defense played the body cam footage. It showed another officer outside the apartment, mentioning a coat inside. A woman's coat, possibly. "You're already here," the officer says. "May as well check to see if it's hers, if it could have belonged to Ashley." So that's what he did. The Warren officer went back inside. This time, looking at the tag on a coat, trying to determine its size. But again, he found no ID, no label, no proof it was Ashley's. The officers exited. And yet, he entered a third time. The Warren officer, now under scrutiny, couldn't recall the reason. "A secondary sweep, maybe?" he said. The defense questioned, "For a body?" "Yes," the officer replied. The defense didn't need to say it. The footage said it for them. They wanted the court to see it for what it was. Three separate entries. No warrant. No emergency. No Ashley. So what was it all for? Lang pressed further. There were nearly seven trained officers already on scene. So why was this officer, the same one who had already swept the apartment, going back inside yet again? Not once, not twice, but three times? Lang suggested the answer was simple. He wasn't going in to look for Ashley. He was going in to look for something else. Specifically, the bleach, gloves, and trash bags LaShawn claimed to have seen ordered on DoorDash. Details she told police after turning over the phone she took from DeAndre's apartment. Lang implied that the search was never really about finding Ashley. It was about finding items that would justify their suspicions. And here's where Lang's strategy gets especially dangerous. Because if the officers weren't looking for Ashley, if their intent was to search for evidence of a crime without a warrant, then that changes everything. Suddenly, this wasn't a protective sweep. It wasn't a welfare check. It was an illegal search. And under the law, that means anything they found, the gloves, the bleach, the trash bags, might be considered fruit of the poisonous tree. In court, that's not just a metaphor. It's grounds for exclusion. Evidence obtained through an unlawful search, especially one done without probable cause or a warrant, can be thrown out entirely. And it doesn't stop there. Even the phone LaShawn handed over. If the chain of custody is challenged, if her entry is deemed unauthorized, if that moment is framed as trespassing or theft, that could unravel the entire foundation of this case. Because if that phone gets thrown out, so do the messages, the orders, the searches. And without those, the prosecution's theory about planning, motive, and concealment starts to crack. Lang knows the power of that implication. And now, so does the court. And this wasn't the only point he wanted to land. The same officer was also the one who received a call from Ashley's mother, Monica, around 2:30 p.m. the next day. She had a tip. Ashley might be at an address in downtown Detroit. The officer passed it along. Detroit police responded. What they found raised even more questions. Shell casings in the driveway. Metal bars surrounding the porch. A man who answered the door claimed he wasn't the owner, but said his cousin was. Minutes later, someone else arrived, this time claiming to be the owner. But the name he gave didn't match the name given by the cousin. Prosecutors firmly objected. Hearsay.
I'm gonna object. I've been trying to be a little lenient, but this is getting nonsensical. I mean, we're getting into 5 and 6 layers of hearsay at a preliminary examination.
I'm not asking it for the truth of the matter.
But you are
asking it to see what his reaction was to all this information.
Did you receive? Then why go through all? Why put it all on the record? Just ask if you received information and can you follow up on it? I mean, he's putting it on because he wants the truth.
Well, I certainly will not consider it.
When officers asked for permission to search inside the Detroit house, they were denied. Lang wasn't just raising doubts. He was planting seeds of confusion, of misdirection, and of the chilling possibility that maybe, just maybe, they had focused on the wrong person all along. But Warren PD never searched the Detroit address. Neither did Detroit PD. Once they learned the tip came from a TextNow number, and after hearing from Detroit officers that shell casings were a dime a dozen in that neighborhood, they let it go. Nothing out of the ordinary, they were told, and nothing more was done. But to Lang, that was the point. This wasn't an investigation. It was a witch hunt. At least, that's what Lang wants a jury to believe. Because once police had a name, once DeAndre became the center of gravity, everything else seemed to orbit around him. Tips that didn't point to him, ignored. Evidence that didn't fit, dismissed. Even a shell casing at a different address wasn't enough to shift their focus. But here's the danger in that narrative. When officers are seen as building a case backward, starting with a suspect, and then collecting evidence to fit, it plants a seed of doubt. And in a courtroom, doubt is everything. It suggests tunnel vision. It suggests bias. And it suggests that maybe they never actually considered that someone else could be responsible. Lang doesn't have to prove who that someone else might be. He only has to prove that police stopped looking. And if a jury believes that, if they believe the investigation was flawed, narrow, or rushed, it won't matter how damning the evidence might seem. Because if the path that led to it was compromised, then justice might be, too. Lang wasn't finished. He called a third officer to the stand, a lieutenant from Roseville PD. And with that, the timeline shifted to January 4th. That's the day a second team of officers returned to DeAndre's apartment, this time spotting what appeared to be blood spatter across multiple surfaces, enough to justify calling in a formal search warrant. But Lang's focus wasn't on the warrant. It was on the footage. Footage that showed something subtle, but potentially explosive. A split door frame. An unhinged deadbolt. In other words, physical evidence that the apartment had been broken into. And that's where Lang began building his next argument. Both the January 3rd team and the January 4th team testified that the door wasn't kicked in or forced by police. It was already open. But if it was open because it had already been broken into, the next question becomes, by whom? Lang didn't offer a direct answer. He didn't need to. Because the court had already heard that multiple people had been inside that apartment before police arrived. Ashley's mother, Monica. Her sister, Anaya. LaShawn Ross. The father of Ashley's children. And at least one other friend. All of them entered that apartment without a warrant. All of them had personal motives. And if any one of them damaged that door, even with the best intentions, it could render the entire search sequence that followed questionable. And in a preliminary hearing, that matters. Because the judge, not a jury, is tasked with deciding if there was probable cause to move forward, and whether the evidence introduced, especially the kind found in that apartment, was gathered lawfully. Which brings us here. If the initial entry into DeAndre's apartment was unlawful, or if the chain of custody of the phone was compromised, then Lang can argue that everything that followed was tainted. That includes the DoorDash order, the cleaning supplies, the body cam footage, the bloody evidence, even the search warrant triggered on January 4th. In legal terms, it's what's known as fruit of the poisonous tree. If the tree, the initial entry, is poisoned, then so is everything that grows from it. Lang doesn't need to win the case today, but he does need to cast doubt on how the case was built. And what he's doing is laying the foundation for a future motion to suppress the most damning evidence before it ever reaches a courtroom with a jury. Because if the judge agrees, if they determine that officers overstepped, even slightly, then the prosecution could be forced to move forward without the very evidence they've built their case on. And that could change everything. By the end of the hearing, the courtroom wasn't left with a clear conclusion, but it was left with a clear strategy. Lang hadn't called these officers just to poke holes. He was laying bricks, one by one, constructing a narrative that suggested everything the prosecution had introduced could be up for challenge. And the judge? He didn't rule on Bindover that day. Instead, he hit pause. With nearly 200 exhibits, footage, photographs, and a lengthy transcript still to be typed, both sides agreed. They needed more time. They'll return to court. But it won't be for more witness testimony. It'll be for oral arguments. A high-stakes moment where both sides will make their case for whether DeAndre should be bound over for trial. The prosecution believes they have what they need. But even strong cases can unravel, especially when investigative missteps are exposed. And that's exactly what Lang is counting on. He'll use every technicality at his disposal to reframe the story into one where the search for Ashley wasn't justified. The evidence was collected unlawfully. Potential leads, like the Detroit tip, were ignored. And the man caught on surveillance might not be the man sitting in the defendant's chair. He's not saying DeAndre is innocent, but he's suggesting that police didn't know that for sure when they acted like they did. And if the judge agrees, it could change everything. What do you think about this tragic case? As we watch this case unfold, it's impossible not to feel for Ashley's family and friends. Their desperation wasn't just emotional, it was action. They showed up. They searched. They pushed when it felt like police weren't moving fast enough. And if it were my family, I believe we'd do the same. Especially knowing now what we didn't then. That Ashley may have been moved hours before police ever arrived at DeAndre's apartment. The surveillance suggests she was taken from the building around 4:35 a.m. On the very same morning, just hours before her loved ones were desperately trying to find her there. By then, she was gone. And so was he. And now, they have to sit through these hearings. They have to listen as a defense attorney not only challenges the police work, but dares to suggest this might not have been DeAndre at all.
I think it was the third or second day when they went through that blood evidence in detail. That was very difficult for the family because then you start to visualize what occurred in that apartment.
Let's be real. The evidence in this case is overwhelming. To float the idea that someone else could be responsible isn't just a stretch. It's insulting. It's a slap in the face to Ashley's family, to her friends, and to all of us who have followed this story from the beginning. Because while the law demands fairness, we also know what we have seen with our own eyes. And we know that justice shouldn't be redefined by a clever strategy. But clever strategies have power. Power to delay justice, to distract from truth, to make us question what we already know. I have a question that still lingers. is DeAndre's erratic behavior a prelude to laying the groundwork for an insanity defense? And beyond that, will this case even make it to trial? Or will he take a plea before a jury ever sees the evidence? And so, the path to trial could shift, and the evidence could unravel. But until the lingering questions are answered and her body is found, this case remains unfinished. That wraps up this episode of Sleuthy Stories. Thanks for joining me as we uncover the twists and turns of real-life cases. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment, please leave a rating. It really helps more true crime fans find us. Want to see the visuals that go with today's case? You can find the full video version on my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. Check the link in the description. I'll be back soon with another case. But until then, keep your wits sharp and your curiosity sharper.